Macro Trading Floor.
With me, Alfonso Peccatiello, founder of the Macro Compass and former head of investments at a large European bank.
And I am Brent Donnelly, president of Spectrum Markets. I've been a portfolio manager, day trader, and market maker at the biggest commercial and investment banks in the United States. I'm also the author of Alpha Trader and The Art of Currency Trading. If you want to know what's going on in markets and where they're going, you found the right podcast.
Welcome back to another episode of the Macro Trading Floor. Alf speaking, and back with me this week, Brent Donnelly. Brent, how are you doing?
Hey, Alf, I'm pretty good. Things are moving around, which is always nice.
Yeah, but now please pronounce my surname. You were doing that offline. You should do it again.
Alfonso Peccatiello.
Beautiful, man. You deserve a pizza with no pineapple on it. Okay, back to it. So I know that you want to start the show with a big rant about modern monetary theory. So please enlighten us.
Sure. So, I mean, I think you can easily argue that since 2017, we've been in a world of MMT or modern monetary theory, which is essentially that fiscal has no limit other than inflation. And then when you reach that limit, then you need to pull back on the fiscal. And the biggest underlying problem with that theory is that it works in theory, but in the real world, they're never going to pull back on fiscal because that's how you get votes. And it's just an easy way to throw money at the economy. Now, at the extreme, you could argue that if inflation was bad enough, then the politics flip and then they need to hike taxes. But that obviously wasn't even the case in 2021. The Inflation Reduction Act was not really a tax increase. It was just a bunch of moving the checkers around on the checkers board. So in that world, then the only offset is tighter Fed policy. But then what's happened since November of 2023, when Waller made his speech, was that Fed policy essentially truncated one part of the distribution. So they said, okay, hikes are off the table. Now it's just a matter of how many cuts and when. And as soon as you do that, then the release valve has to be more inflation, higher inflation expectations, looser financial conditions. And that's exactly what we've seen. So until the day when the Fed says, okay, actually hikes are back on the table, I feel like the reflation trade is the path of least resistance, because you're in a world of loose fiscal and loose monetary policy. Now we can argue where our star is and whether monetary policy is loose with real rates at 2%. But the reality is, in the world of financial conditions and commodities, the Fed policy is loose right now. I mean, just based on what the market is doing. And will that be the case in the future? Maybe, maybe not. But for now, I think that's the way. And we had a strong CPI this week, which in theory should have pulled back on that and potentially move the needle. But if you look at commodities have barely sold off. So copper, gold, and friends are still very bid. And I think the reason is that there's no credible threat of Fed hikes still. So until the credible threat of Fed hikes appears, then the reflation trade is on.
This is one of the most elegant things I've heard about macro over the last few months. Nice. Let me chime in with something less interesting. No, I'll try my best. So basically, Brent, you're saying that in short, unless rates and the rates distribution sells off to incorporate Fed hikes, not as a tail scenario, but as actually a possibility, basically until two-year rates are trading well north of 5%, north of 5%, sustainably so, which basically incorporates the potential of hikes into the distribution, and then potentially the long end also joins in the sell-off, until we get to that point and to a breaking point, which is unknown at the end of the day. So what is the level of two-year, five-year, 10-year rates, which is going to cause trouble in risk assets? Until we get there, the market is going to try to look for that breaking point and is going to basically use either the long end as the release valve for what? The Fed is still talking about cuts. They're not talking about hikes. They're talking about cuts. So we're going to, you know, push up the long end as a result, the term premium is going to push 30-year rates higher. And then something finally is going to start cracking a little bit in equities and in credit. Or the Fed is actually going to start talking about hikes. And then it's the front end that goes up a lot more. And it's basically the rates volatility that comes down, breaking the entire loop. If that doesn't happen, while that doesn't happen, you're saying the market will still go up and chase this reflation narrative, chase the idea that we aren't tight at all.
And then there's two ways of looking at Fed policy. Like if you overlay a chart of US 2-year yields and Fed funds, essentially you can often make the argument that the market is telling the Fed when to hike. And then sometimes the Fed will cut on its own without the market, but very rarely will it hike on its own without the market actually being above. So generally 2-year rates are above Fed funds almost every single time that they hike. And that's true with every, if you look at New Zealand, they've never hiked unless the 2-year yield was above the OCR. So generally central banks don't really want to hike. So they'll hike when they're forced to hike. So if US 2-year yields get up close to the level of Fed funds, that's obviously the market putting pressure on the Fed. And then the alternate to that would be, so that's one scenario where things actually start getting tight. The alternate is if someone big at the Fed says, oh shit, actually we could hike. So the headline would be, you know, so-and-so, I don't know who, Waller or Williams or somebody says, cannot rule out the possibility of more Fed hikes given recent reacceleration of inflation, or some headline like that. Those are the two things that I think will then tighten the vise enough that this will stop. But in the meantime, you can get yields up and commodities up. I mean, we saw that a lot in 2021. And ultimately, because it's kind of circular, because oil obviously drives inflation, but it's also viewed as a hedge for inflation because of the very nature of it driving the inflation. So things like oil and copper and all that, especially as it looks like we've troughed in terms of the global manufacturing cycle, like we talked about last week. So all these conditions are still bullish for commodities. And honestly, the dollar has rallied quite a bit on the CPI data. I think partly people were just leaning, including me, we're leaning the wrong way. So you've seen like a big wipeout. But I do think that in the end, all of this mix that we're describing, I don't think it's really that bullish dollar, because you're really still seeing loose fiscal, loose monetary, and an environment where financial conditions are still somewhat loose. So I think it's kind of negative fiat currencies in general. And eventually it's probably neutral dollar, and then eventually negative dollar again once things settle.
I was waiting for you on the not positive dollar against what, because I tend to disagree. I think it's positive dollar against other currencies, because you can't out-hawk the Federal Reserve, basically, neither at the front end nor at the long end. I mean, what currency would you like to be long the dollar against this in an environment where you just said rates are going to be tried to push basically for higher and higher level until we figure out, right, what is the new equilibrium or the new breakage level? So where do you think yield differentials can go in dollar versus euro, or dollar versus sterling, or dollars versus Canada or Australia? I mean, all these other central banks are apparently not able to out-hawk the Federal Reserve. But I agree with you instead that this is a weird environment where the dollar can appreciate maybe against the euro or a certain emerging markets. I talked about Brazil a week ago. At the same time, it can weaken against gold or copper or oil, exactly for this reflation narrative that you are discussing, exactly for this market looking for the release valve, right? And right now it seems to be commodities. Might become the long end, might become the front end. For now, it's commodities. By the way, I'd like to see the headline of Williams saying exactly, oh shit, we might be hiking. Like literally, Bloomberg says, oh shit.
SH asterisk T on the Bloomberg. Honestly, I'm not going to push back too much on what you said, because if you look at the ECB and Bank of Canada this week, they are essentially opening the door for June cuts, whereas that's getting completely priced out in the US. And it's interesting, because I remember when I was in Brazil, which was the end of January, the script from everyone was the Fed will cut first, and then one by one, all the minions will fall in line and everyone will cut to follow the Fed. And in fact, the script, it's exactly flipped. So it looks like it's going to be the Fed last. And then you've got Bank of Canada and ECB this week opening up June. And just one quick thing, I don't know if listeners really care about Canada that much, but I do since I'm from there. Next week, we're going to get CPI from Canada.
Yeah.
And it's always important when you're looking at economic data to understand whether that data has any beta to central bank policy and to the currency and to rates. And the times when it doesn't matter is when a central bank's on autopilot or there's nothing priced in and nothing's going to change there. But with something like the Bank of Canada, it's priced exactly 50-50 right now for June. So 50% chance of a cut, 50% chance of nothing. So in that case, there's a lot of flexibility in the market to price something, obviously to go to 100% or to go to zero.
Yeah.
And that, so that Canadian CPI number next week, you know, if Canada CPI is usually a 4 out of 10 for me in terms of importance, I would put it as an 8 out of 10. So that's the kind of event that if you can own it at a reasonable price or just be ready to trade it, I think that'll be a super tradable event next week.
Very nice point that I would like also to elaborate a bit on. If you have ahead of an event, a distribution of probability that is, let's say, very broad, that means that it's going to be relatively hard to come out of the event with a surprise. But if, for example, you now have a distribution where it's a 50-50 scenario, at some point you've got to converge to zero or 100, right? And that can be a lot more of a volatile event or a setup, which for trading can be interesting. But talking about Canada, so they have a 55% chance of cutting, as looking now on the screen. Europe has a 78% of cutting rates by June, right? So it goes a bit into what I was saying before. It seems the Swiss National Bank has basically paved the way for other central banks to show how strong and independent they are from the Federal Reserve, Brent. You know, the SNB went and cut rates and now everybody's like, oh, okay, I'm also a grown-up central banker. I'm not going to be waiting for the Fed. I can go ahead and I can cut rates. I think that feeds a little bit into this idea I have that the breakage point, the release valve that markets are looking for here can be actually a few things. Can be the short end if the Fed talks about hikes. Can be the long end if the Fed doesn't talk about hikes. And the long end basically prices in more term premium, more uncertainty. So it's long end yields that go up. Or third, in my opinion, it can be the dollar. And the dollar versus certain emerging markets, for example, or more vulnerable economies can actually generate quite a lot of trouble. We have seen it already in September, October last year, where yes, yields were going up, but also the dollar was going up nonstop against a bunch of markets and emerging markets. And I think that can also be something to take a look at. So we're in this weird situation where the dollar can rally, in my opinion, against other currencies, but gold and copper and oil can rally against the dollar. I think that's
what we are. Yeah, and you know, one trade that people, this was very popular during the Eurozone crisis, and doesn't really get that much airplay, but I think it's a really good trade just as a pair to consider when there's a scenario where the correlation has come off. So just a quick note, in the past, before COVID, almost always the dollar and gold were extremely highly correlated. So betting on lower euro dollar and higher gold just generally didn't really make that much sense because the correlation was so strong that you're just hedging yourself. But now that's not really the case. So something like being long gold and short euros, instead of being long gold, short dollars, which is the normal pair, being long gold, short euros, yeah, or something like that really is the ultimate expression of, you know, all this 13 minutes of everything that we've been talking about. That's really the ultimate expression of that, because then you don't have a dollar, you don't have a dollar short, but you're essentially short fiat and you're short one of the worst fiats that's about to cut. And also then you're not worrying about the carry, because one thing about gold is, like, obviously it doesn't matter if it's going up 2% a day, but eventually you are paying a lot of carry to be long gold. So being long gold and short a very low interest rate currency like Swiss or yen or euro just often makes more sense to me. And like I said, in an environment where correlations are not that strong the way they used to be, then it makes even more sense.
Yeah. So in the Eurozone, we are known for good food and art, but not particularly for a strong economy and a very assertive central bank. So feel free to short the euro as your second leg versus long commodities, you know, can be long oil versus euro or long gold versus euro, for example. One thing I want to touch upon though, Brent, is yes, we're talking about the release valves, right? So basically the market trying to show the reflation narrative a way or another, the long end, commodities, maybe the short end. But the question I get a lot from my clients is, Yes, Alf, I get it. I understand the market is looking for a breakage point, but what the hell? It used to be way easier to break something than it is today. Like in 2018, and that's a typical example that they bring, and it's a right one. 30-year rates went to 3.4%, 3.4%. And then the high yield market was like, I am sorry, I'm going to shut down. No issuance allowed. 54 trading days of no high yield corporate deal. None. I was running money back at the bank. I could not find a single issuer that was brave enough to come to the market. 54 days. And so the Fed said, okay, sorry guys, we were too tight. I'm sorry. Powell said in January 2019, he pivoted, so on and so forth. And now they're saying, yeah, but 30-year rates are about to go to 5 again. And it seems like in September 2023, they had to go to 5 before becoming really restrictive. What the hell? There's a big difference between 5% and 3.4. So has something structurally changed? And
I mean, sorry, go ahead, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to finish my rant by saying that if I look at periods like 2017 or 2007, which is another interesting period because the Fed had hiked interest rates in 2006 a lot, then they had paused for 15 months. So quite a long pause. And I remember somewhere like summer 2007, it was a bit of the same feeling, like, holy crap, I mean, the US economy can take a lot. Like, you can hike rates, keep them at 5%, the housing market keeps going. And that was basically the story. And it seems kind of similar now, but I think this time can be even way longer as potential lags, because in 2007, we ultimately ended up breaking something because it was the private sector, which was levered like hell. We had created money through the housing and the mortgage machine in the US. And so if you raise interest rates and you keep them tighter for longer, at some point you're going to break a private sector leverage machine. But today, Brent, as you were saying, it's not a private sector thing. It's an MMT, or it's a magic money tree, as my mentor used to say, a modern monetary theory. It's a fiscal thing, okay? And the limitations to fiscal really are there. I mean, the long end can sell off, it's term premium, it's inflation risks, but those are much less urgent risks, I would say, than raising rates or mortgage rates to 7% with the highly leveraged housing market, like in 2007. I think those are very different type of risks, and I think it takes longer for the fiscal risks to really resurface.
Right, and I mean, that's the biggest question in this cycle, which is a frustration of economics. And I think it's one of the reasons that the yield curve going inverted is such a useless signal, because it has a perfect track record, but the timing is unknowable. So then what do you do with that? And there's, with very little corporate leverage in the system and credit spreads still super tight, the question then becomes, what's the transmission mechanism? So like normally in the cycle, the transmission mechanism is, in 06, 07, it was housing, and housing broke, but then it just took a long time for that to matter. But eventually employment and construction and related employment and all that cratered. But it's just not that obvious right now. What's the transmission mechanism? Like, there's so much trapped demand in housing. It's rates have already gone up so much. US mortgage holders are locked in at 2.875 until whatever, like 2027, people will start seeing their mortgages roll. The mortgages are already resetting in some of the other countries, which is causing a bit of damage. But in the US, you have corporates rolled at their debt at the lows, and the maturity wall seems to be more like a curb that people are just stepping over. So then what is the transmission mechanism? And like you said, maybe the transmission mechanism is eventually that yields go up and the back end craps out, and then we get a repeat of what happened in the UK in 2022. Which was the bond vigilantes appear and they say, okay, we're not funding this anymore. This is stupid. And, you know, will we get that to that in the US? I think that's possible. Like, it felt like we were on the very, very, very front edge of that when rates got to 5%, and then Yellen dropped the QRA bomb, I guess, on yields. But other than that, what's the transmission mechanism? Unless you get mortgage rates to 8 or something, it feels like there's just not a clear mechanism for higher yields leading to something breaking. And then the perverse thing is that there are mechanisms where higher yields have actually led to stimulus, where people have money. You know, if you have money in the bank, you're now making interest on it. If you have Social Security, your nominal checks are going up because of inflation. So it's a really confusing situation. And again, like I said at the start of this comment, it's a frustration of economics is that no one before this hiking cycle was screaming from the rooftops, or maybe somebody was, but not many people screaming from the rooftops, hey, the Fed's going to hike and that's going to be stimulative. But then we do all this ex post analysis of like, oh, okay, I guess Fed hikes are stimulative now. And, you know, where, what are we even doing here? Sometimes I wonder, but in the end, I guess all you can do is observe and keep on recalibrating your models and your mental frameworks to kind of figure out what the hell's going on this time.
The fun part, Brent, is that last time we heard, I mean, normally when you start having people really review their models and also coming up with a bit more creative theories, for example, that hikes are stimulative, normally you are close to the moment when you actually have to buy bonds. In September 2023, I had a few people lecture me on what term premium is, and I never heard them even know what term premium was before, but they read a couple of papers. So they wanted to, you know, tell me what term premium is. And it was 3 days before the top in yields. Okay. So term premium was everywhere. Everybody was, you know, wanted to find out what term premium is because 30-year rates were going to 5%. And now Fed hikes are stimulative. I would say there are merits into this thesis. Yes, there are, because a balance sheet is made of assets and liabilities. So a hiking cycle is supposed to weaken demand and slow down the economy because refinancing your liabilities becomes damn expensive. And so your earnings and your income and your cash flows have to be used way more for debt servicing than for anything else. So then you're going to slow consumption. This is the normal way that a hiking cycle works. Hey, dude, if your next refinancing is in 30 years, guess what? It doesn't matter. You don't have any negative impact on your liability side because your debt are not floating. They're fixed. So no pass-through immediate, no refinancing cliffs, no nothing. So what's the impact? Well, it takes a long time until you actually feel it. But on the asset side, it looks great. All your assets are doing great. In nominal terms, they're performing. Your treasuries are bringing in more money. So there is actually a merit, I think, to this thesis. Although one must recognize, I think you call it the cheer hedge, when somebody has a very complicated stuff on and, you know, it works. And in this case, it's a thesis, you know, and then they become more vocal. It's like, I told you that hikes were stimulative. It's generally to be taken with a pinch of salt. Like maybe it's a bit of a contrarian signal. Maybe we are reaching the top actually of this cycle. I don't know. It worked in September 2023. I'm not sure whether it's going to work this time as well.
Yeah, I mean, it does smack of this time is different, and people like to, you know, crap on that saying. But at the same time, this time is different. I mean, you just can't deny that this cycle is completely, completely different from any cycle that we've ever lived through. It's just there's so many factors that are different.
Yes, I think so. All right, so let's talk about a more technical thing, which is it's the 11th of April, and if you are a US listener, you gotta pay your taxes. And therefore, there is some quite weird behavior going on, right? So let's chat about tax seasonality, first from a market perspective and then from a liquidity perspective. I'll leave the seasonal market behavior to you.
Yeah, so I find this weirdly interesting. I mean, I love this stuff, this seasonality stuff. But there's a situation where essentially the way that the flows are distributed is that a lot of tax refunds are issued in March. And so there's a theory of seasonality, which I subscribe to, which is that the flows drive the price of equities to a certain extent, not obviously macro matters, but at any given moment, sometimes flows can be more important than macro. And so you see at the end of the year and the start of the year, for example, there's a lot of bonus payments and people getting extra income, and some portion of that goes in the stock market, and the stock market tends to go up. If you zoom in, you can even see it on a tinier fractal. If you look at the performance of the S&P over the month, it tends to rally at the start and the end of the month. And the simple reason is that that's when people get paid. And so when I get my pay, some portion of it is a 401k retirement fund deduction, and that money is automatically deployed. And that automatic deployment creates demand for stocks that's unconditional at the start and the end of the month. So if you map the performance of stocks by day of month, it you see it there. So now, though, as you get close to April 15th, what you have is the last minute. So generally, people that want refunds file early because you want the money, and people that owe tend to procrastinate and file late. So then what you see as April 15 approaches, and this is especially true in years when assets went up a lot last year, because then people are more likely to owe money.
Yeah.
You see that the stock market tends to sell off into April 15th as people raise money to pay for those taxes. So if you look at it in like 99, 2000 or 2021, which were all, or sorry, 2022, which are all years after a big spec thing happened, you see the sell-off is very dramatic. And interestingly, actually in 2022, they moved the tax deadline because of something. I forget, I think something in California. So they moved it to May 17th. And actually stocks were stable around April 15th, and then they sold off into May 17th that year. So to me, that's an interesting controlled experiment that shows that this flow is real.
Yeah.
So anyways, all that to say that it's generally a risky time of the year to be long stocks between now and this Monday, which is April 15th. And then once that flow subsides, you tend to see a sharp rally for the second half of April. So I never use these seasonal flow kind of analyses as the be all end all. What I look at is this creates a probabilistic setup where all other things being equal, stocks are more likely to go down now until April 15th, and then more likely to rally once that unconditional selling is done. But it's got to be part of a bigger framework where you have other reasons to make your decisions.
Yeah. In 2022, with the delayed tax deadline, the Treasury General Account went up because the government, of course, taxes you, so they get more money in their Treasury General Account. The Treasury General Account went up from 550 billion to 950. So went up by $400 billion, okay, during the tax season. And then, of course, the government slowly but surely reinjects this money into the economy. And therefore, you have the usual seasonal TGA drawdown in the second half of the year. Now, today, we're at 770 billion. So if the tax receipts, let's say, during this tax season should be anywhere similar to 2022, the TGA would go north of a trillion, I'm sorry. And the reason why I'm saying this is that last time we heard from Janet Yellen about her target size of the TGA was at the last quarterly refunding announcement, so about 3 months ago already. And she said that they're targeting 750 billion. Okay. Now, we hear again by her at the end of the month. So at the end of the month, we'll get a refresh. How many issuance will the US do? Will they be bills? Will they be coupon bonds? What's the Treasury General Account target? 750 billion is actually a pretty high number for the Treasury General Account. Normally, the US runs at about 400, 300, 500 billion. The reason why I'm saying that is if Yellen would want to move that Treasury General Account target, let's say to 500 billion, okay, for the next quarter, and we start from a trillion after the tax season, you basically have about 500 billion of cash that sits into the government account at the Fed that can be released into the real economy. Guys, this is not financial type of money, interbank reserves, da 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 da. You are releasing literal money that you can throw to people, okay? So you can cut taxes, accommodate, spend, anything that the government can do from a fiscal perspective. It's a 500 billion potential war chest that Yellen has or can use between now and September. So that requires her to change the Treasury General Account target, let's say, to a more historically average level of 500 billion. And also, it requires tax season to be strong enough. There are no reasons for the tax season to be weak because the stock market has been going through the roof. It's full employment. The tax season should be strong enough. And then all eyes on the quarterly refunding announcement, which is somewhere at the end of April, I think the 29th, if I'm not mistaken, but at the end of April. And that could actually play quite a role when it comes to the monetary plumbing, because a big drop of the Treasury General Account or a projected one could actually unleash more animal spirits in markets and also in the economy, because it's a short-term injection of actual money in the real economy.
That's an interesting point about the QRA, because I feel like it was such an important thing there for a very short time last year. And so but now people have kind of forgotten about it. So I'll definitely put that on my calendar for April, whatever it is, 29th, 30th, whenever that is.
Yeah, one of these 2 days. I got to check the exact day, but it should be one of these two. And then we are here to try and tell people what are our top trade ideas. So Brent, shoot it.
Sure. So generally, I just want to clarify that I'm a short-term trader. So my time horizon is usually like 1 day to 7 days. Uh-huh. So this podcast fits perfectly for that. So anything that I say, first of all, is not investment advice, but second of all, it has a half-life of 1 week. So it actually works well with this podcast. So there's no point thinking about like trades that I said 4 weeks ago or whatever. Every week I'm going to say my view, and it's only good for 1 week. So, and then good for 7 days, then canceled. This week is kind of going with the whole conversation that we had, is I think oil is ready to go up into the 90s. It's been very stable in the face of the high CPI. And you can say this about it, all the commodities. So I'm picking oil simply because I like the chart and it's at the bottom of the range. So I think oil up into next week. So if I'm very, very right, or, you know, NYMEX is trading around 85.30 right now. If I'm very, very right, maybe it's like 88.90 next week. If I'm a little bit right, maybe it's on the lower end of like 87, 88, but that I think oil higher into next week, as we still have some combination of loose fiscal, loose monetary, even though CPI came in strong.
Okay, for me, the trade idea is being long dollar and short South African rand. And the idea is that I think the third release valve, I mean, we talked about three release valves, right? Commodities, bonds, or the dollar. And or, I mean, all these three can actually happen together, by the way. Eh? And they are happening together as we speak. Bond yields are going up, commodities are going up, the dollar is going up. Quite interesting. I think the dollar is an interesting one because it can create quite some damage, especially against vulnerable countries. And South Africa scores pretty high on the list. They have an election coming up on May 29th. And they have a fiscal deficit situation, so they have a bit of budget irresponsibility going on. They have quite the political turmoil at home. These elections are going to be quite interesting. It's been a big crowd at carry trade, a bit like Brazil, which I suggested to go short, I think, like 4 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Or Mexico. South Africa is another high-yielding currency. I think if you start having a trend that, you know, causes some vol for people who are long South Africa because of carry, they'll have to get out. And anyway, it's always a good idea to get out before a political event. So I think the dollar South Africa is quite interesting, can become pretty convex as a potential P&L driver.
So one thing I would mention about the rand too is that, just as a general rule, if you believe that carry has been a big theme, which it, I think most people would agree with that,
yeah,
the most of the carry baskets in FX do some kind of weighted distribution of all the different currencies. And so they're going to own Rand. It's been a pretty good performer from a carry point of view. But then what they'll do is they'll always look forward some amount. So maybe they use 1 month vol or 2 month vol to look at the sizing. And by definition, as the election comes closer, then those vol metrics, you know, the implied vol going forward is going to be higher by definition.
Yeah.
So as you get closer to the event, there's forced liquidation as people reduce their position size. And that's just generally true of all events, but it will definitely be true in South Africa. So I would think that that will help as May 29th gets close. More and more people or systematic carry funds are just going to reduce because of the potential for a VAR shock.
At least I hope so. And then it's time to talk about the most stupid thing we read this week, and fun as well. And I'm not going to say the smart one, because the most stupid is so fun that I have to chime in on that as well. But please, Brent, enlighten us.
All right. I'm going to just say a quick smart thing, because we can put it in the show notes. I don't have to go too long about it, but I would strongly recommend that everyone read The Anguish of Central Banking by Arthur Burns. It's a speech he gave after he left, which essentially was a mea culpa, saying, here's why inflation went up and here's what we did wrong. And the way that he talks about the interplay between societal, fiscal, and monetary forces is crazy. It's so similar to right now. It's the things like seven pages. It's worth a read. And then the stupidest thing was, I actually haven't been on Twitter much this week. So I canvassed Twitter, and somebody named Dave sent me a tweet of someone that showed the S&P 500 divided by the Fed balance sheet. And then the implication was, stocks actually have not gone up at all since 2008, is what the tweet said. And I mean, in a nutshell, dividing a nominal figure like that by the Fed's balance sheet, which is not tradable, is not an appropriate unit for measurement in the real world. Like, it literally means nothing. Nobody is owning S&Ps, you know, under the constraint of a denominator of the Fed balance sheet. It's just nonsense. In fact, it actually, what it does show is that stocks are a pretty good hedge against debasement. So if anything, the implication of the tweet is exactly backwards.
Okay, let me chime in into this. It's a topic. It's very close to my heart. So I'm going to ask people who do this and they like dividing stuff by the Fed balance sheet, if you can go and buy a pizza paying in Fed balance sheet. I don't think you can. You can pay in dollars, you can pay in gold. So fair enough. If you want to divide stuff by gold, I see the point. You can divide stuff by your wage. If you want to say how many hours of my wage does it take to buy an S&P, fair. How many dollars does it take to buy a pizza? Fair. How many Fed balance sheet does it take to buy a pizza? No, sorry, you can't do that. It doesn't make
any
sense.
Actually, what we should do is create a meme coin called Fed balance sheet with hat.
Fed balance sheet with hat, precisely. Something like that. Beautiful. Okay, that's an idea. If anyone is in crypto and wants to go ahead, please, we own the copyright of this. Fed balance sheet with hat is our meme coin. It's from the macro trading floor. And it goes up. It goes always up. I mean, it's undeniable. And the other thing is, enough. We have shit enough of this on this idea. It's stupid enough. People got it. You don't divide stuff by the Fed balance sheet, please. Anything else, Brent, you'd like to add?
No, I think we covered everything. And next week, like I said, watch out for Canada CPI. And then also just keep an eye on commodities in general, because I feel like they're the ultimate expression of the loose trade. And I think that continues.
Yes, the release valves, ladies and gentlemen, commodities, bond markets, and the dollar. Keep an eye on those because the pressure might be rising. At least it's fun for us. We have more macro vol. We don't fall asleep hearing Lagarde repeat for 20 times and bashing every journalist. Hey, you asked 3 questions, not 2 questions. So it's a little bit more fun, you know. Talk to you again next Sunday. Ciao from Alf.
All right. Thanks, everybody. See you next week.
The content provided on the Macro Trading Floor podcast is for general information purposes only. No information or other content provided in this podcast should be considered as investment advice. Seek independent professional consultation in the form of legal, financial, and fiscal advice before making any investment decision. Always perform your own due diligence.